Well done. Okay, and to introduce our speaker tonight, we're going to have Roger.
Okay, I get to introduce my friend Cynthia. I'd love to hear her share, and I've heard her speak a few times, and you guys are in for a great talk. Here you go.
Hi, I'm Cynthia. So I go to a 50-50 meeting pretty regularly, which I know is not official, but I go. And then I go to some open AA meetings, and I'm always, when they share the chapter 3 from the Big Book, and they talk about proving to themselves that they really are alcoholic because of all the crazy things that they try, and you've probably heard it says, here are some of the things we tried, and it says, taking a trip, not taking a trip, and changing from brandy to scotch, and drinking wine, you know, I'm sure you've heard that. So I've always thought to myself, you know, Al-Anons need something like that. So I took a little stab at it. And in my case, since I was married to an alcoholic and I also have given birth to some, I am, I have two parts of it. So, all right, so here's the little preamble. Despite our best efforts, we have failed to change, improve, better, control, and certainly sober up our loved ones. If any of you are able to fix your loved ones, by all means, let us know. Write a book, and we will all buy it to add to our self-help collection. Here are some of the methods we have used. Now, this is for spouses or partners. Buying alcohol so that we will drink at home. Not buying alcohol. Drinking with them. Not drinking with them. Raising our voices, giving them the silent treatment. Being extra nice, giving them the cold shoulder. Showing them just how really hurt we are. Sleeping with them, not sleeping with them. Losing weight, making ourselves more attractive, letting ourselves go. Checking the phone records, laying a trap to catch them in the act. Being devoted and staying by their side, or even leaving them and filing for divorce. None of it works. Here's kids. Giving them gifts, not giving them gifts. Paying their rent, not paying their rent. Buying the video game, not buying the video game. Moving to a new town, cutting off bad friends, driving them everywhere, promising rewards, following, listening in, finding hidden bottles and drugs, either secretly or in plain sight, so that they know that we know, because of course that makes a big difference, right? Letting them move in, kicking them out, paying for rehab, calling their sponsor, checking up on their attendance in AA meetings, and paying for rehab again. We have tried all these methods and many more to convince our alcoholic loved ones of the folly of their ways, all the while creating havoc and insanity in our own lives. We could increase the list ad infinitum. So now I have satisfaction because I've been thinking that for a long time. So my name is Cynthia, and I'm the granddaughter of an alcoholic. So that's where the first part of the influence on my life came, because it deeply, deeply affected my mom. And then I married an alcoholic and spent a good bit of time with him. And then, pop, I gave birth to some. So I've seen the effects of alcoholism in different ways, and it's all affected me. And I really don't blame anybody for any misery that I currently have. I'm the author of my own misery if I have it now. And in, you know, as we often say, I'm grateful despite some pretty horrific things that I've been through, because I have such a gift of having this program and the ability to look at life differently. I have many friends that are not in the program, and I watch how they struggle and how they take things so personally, and they have that hyper sense of responsibility to fix everything and everybody. And I feel really blessed that I might still do that, but at least I know it's not going to do any good. So, you know, that's freedom. So, my mom, just a little bit of my background. My mom had lost her mother when she was really young. She was 14, and she had younger sisters, and when her mom died, her father, who had always had a bit of a drinking problem, kind of went off the rails and started drinking a lot and womanizing, whatever. So my mom was left to pretty much raise her younger sisters. So she, it's funny because she talks about her childhood and youth and pretty much any other part of her time, and all she tells us is negative stories, and I kind of tease her about it because it's like, you know, one calamity after the other. And, you know, she grew up in Hawaii, which sounds like that'd be really nice, right? But she talks about all the terrible pollen in the air and the, you know, sunburns. And this was, you know, she lived in Hawaii during World War II, so then there was the sailors, that was no good. So a lot of stuff, you know, all her memories are negative. And she brought that into raising her six kids. I'm number five out of six. She also convinced herself that, like her mother, she would die young. So one of the things that she brought to her parenting is that she wanted to make sure that we were not dependent on her, because she felt that you know, that she would have been better off if her mom had let her be more independent. So we were all, like, you know, standing on chairs and frying ourselves eggs by the time we were 4 or 5 years old, that kind of thing. And, you know, I don't know what that has to do with anything, but, you know, she just had a kind of a twisted little view of the world because of what she'd been dealt. And she knew that I was going to be speaking. I have something else coming up, too, that I told her about this fall. And she goes, "Well, you're not going to talk about yourself, are you?" And I go, "No, Mom, I'm going to give a lecture on the biochemical changes in the alcoholic brain from what do I know except myself, you know?" So it's a little strange for her, and if she knew that I just talked about her, that would be really bad. But she's not likely to get the tape, so. So she married she met my dad, and this was, he was one of those sailors, actually. He was an officer in the Navy, and my mom and dad met and ended up coming to, you know, they would say coming to America, although I think it was already a state at the time, you know. You know, my siblings and I were raised in various parts of the country, but I found out, I was telling John this earlier, that I found out when I was 19 that there were two more that none of my siblings and I knew about, and I'm the fifth one, so the other siblings, none of us knew that. But then we found out that I was the first legitimate one, being number five. So during the 50s, my mom was shacked up with a married man having babies, who knew? And it's amazing the secrets that you can keep, you know? And I know my dad was really relieved when that came out, and when he passed, you know, my half siblings were there and it wasn't weird. So that was good. So I'm number five out of six, and I always felt an emptiness. You know, I felt very invisible. I have one sister who was a ballet dancer, and one sister who played the flute and drew beautifully, and then a brother who ended up getting a PhD in math, and even my kid sister became an attorney, and, you know, they all had all these talents, and I felt very invisible. So I did a lot of things to make, you know, in fact, to this day, I do a lot of things to bring attention to myself. And that was just, I just always had a need. And even as a little kid, I had a spiritual need, and I was aware of that. My parents were agnostic and, you know, very intellectual, and they didn't practice any kind of religion. So I found families in the neighborhood and ended up going to Sunday school. I remember I was like 8 years old, and I went through the whole program to join the Nazarene Church. I'm sure I was the youngest member of the church, but, you know, I was always always drawn to that. And until I found a substitute for that, and that was boys, and I found that, you know, and I was running. But I, you know, in my quest for attention, I also did some, you know, minor league drugs and alcohol as a very young teenager, and I remember feeling like if they caught me, then they would know how unhappy I was, and they would, you know, love me or whatever. So it was just a little crazy. I knew I was gonna need some water. So when I was doing that little craziness, I kind of scared myself because I'm not an alcoholic, I'm an Al-Anon. And so I saw the path that I was taking and I went, oh crap, I can't do that. So one of my friends from childhood who I attended church with before invited me, and we went to the youth group, and there were very cute guys with guitars. So I was like, yeah, this is for me. So then then my pendulum sort of went that way, and I became really involved in that. I was the president of the Campus Christian Fellowship, and I did, you know, went way that way, and I ended up going to Bible college. So down here in Los Angeles to go to Bible college, and that's when I was working, because my parents said to me, if you go to real college, we'll pay for it, but if you go there, we're not going to pay for it. So I had to work, and I was, and that's when I met my husband, and my husband was, he was in college, and I was in college, although not real college, but he was in real college, and he was just about ready to graduate, and he had like a couple of science units left to take, and he said, you know, should I take this, I can't even remember what the one option was, but should I take this or should I take the geography of wine? Because it was a class where it was like an excuse for wine tasting, but it was all about, you know, microclimates and weather, and you got some kind of meteorology kind of units for it. And that should have been my first clue, right? He wanted, you know, so that was one of his last classes his senior year, was learning how to scientifically taste wine. And we worked together, we were bank tellers together, and we had these parties, the whole gang of employees would have parties, and I can't tell you how often I would be driving him home passed out, and you know, that I didn't think anything of that. And I partied too, you know, at that point. I mean, I sort of left the whole churchy thing when I was kind of going back the other way again. But you know, I partied too, but never to that extent. And you know, his family was immigrants from Denmark, and that alcohol was just a huge part of the whole lifestyle. And you know, it's funny how every ethnicity says that, right? Well, we're Italian, so we drank, and we're German, so we drank, and whatever, you know. So I think it's just being human, you know, is what I think. But I can say that I went to Denmark, and I kid you not, you'd get up and you'd have coffee and a little schnapps. And then you'd have like a little mid-morning snack, and you'd have, you know, something else. It's just this nasty thing called gommel dance, which means old Dane. It's really nasty, like worse than Jägermeister, just nasty. Anyway, and then you'd have lunch, which was the main meal, so they'd have like the open-faced sandwiches, whatever, and you'd have beers with that. And then, you know, I don't know if you know what akavit is, but it's a little like liqueur. And you have open-faced sandwiches that have fish, and then you say, fish have to swim, so then you're having that. And then in the afternoon, you know, I mean, you get the, you know, it's like, it literally, I imagine that probably because we had relatives from America and they were, you know, putting on the big show for us, that maybe they don't do that every day, but it was incredible, the amount. So I'm here to say Danes definitely have that in their culture, for sure. So we get married and do our thing, both working and whatever. We didn't have kids for a lot of years. We were married 8 years. And about the time that I started having children, I thought, okay, well, now we're done with that, and now it's time to be grown up and to stop partying and whatever. And that wasn't where he was at. We had a lot of problems. We had a lot of difficulties, which I can't blame it all on alcohol. I think his, you know, they say his rocks hit my holes, or my rocks hit his. And we just had a really, it was a dance, you know, that you just, bring out the worst in each other, the best in each other, and whatever. I mean, there's things about our lives together that are really great. I can look back and I can say, oh, you know, we traveled a lot and you know, a lot of cultural things we enjoyed together, or whatever. But then there was also a lot of ugliness, a lot of you know, that feeling of being invisible and being unworthy and being like something was wrong with me. And he was very happy to tell me that, oh, yes, there is something wrong with you. And, you know, every fight and everything became about me. And part of my story is that I gained a lot of weight in that marriage. And it was like, he drank, I ate. And you get it. And everything in our marriage, every problem in our marriage was because I was fat. You know, it was like the elephant in the living room, they say, you know, my elephant was out there for everybody to see and comment on and blame, and his was not, you know. So when my marriage ended, it literally took me about 2 years to unlearn some of the things. And, you know, that was my part in it, you know, was that I had such low self-esteem to begin with, that I was very willing to you know, believe that and take it in. And I was also, you know, that hypersensitivity and also responsibility. Like, you know, my marriage is my responsibility, and if he's unhappy and we're fighting all the time, it must be me, you know. So I took a lot of that in. But that was later. So we started having children. And actually, before that, we were married 7 years, and it was a very dark, unhappy time. And I thought to myself, you know, I have a high tolerance for pain, and I could keep doing this, but I wouldn't want to bring kids into it. So I left him, and I was gone for like, I don't know, 6 months. I quit claimed the house and got him his own. I got him his own car insurance policy and got mine, and you know, I separated the bank accounts. I'm like, I'm done, you know. And I, it's funny when I think about it now, because what he ended up doing was going to Codependents Anonymous, you know, and wooing me back. So I guess there was more evidence that it was my weight that was a problem. He needed to go to CODA to deal with an overeating wife, not his alcohol. But we got back together, and I immediately had my first son. And then over the years, I thought to myself, oh, I was out, you know. But what are you going to do? I love my children. I'm glad that we had them. But so we start having kids, and he started having some really dark spells. And so I had one son. He's now 25. And then my daughter is now 23. And when my daughter was 23, he didn't like touch her for the first 6 months. He was in this really dark place. And that was about the time that he got his first DUI. And that was the first time that we thought maybe the alcohol had something to do with it. You know, that was the first time that we called it that. We had lots of therapy, lots of marriage counseling, you know, yeah, all that stuff. And you know, the alcohol just was never brought up, you know. But after you have a DUI, and then they send you to AA meetings and whatever, and it started to be in our consciousness a little bit more. Had our third kid, and he had a job in banking. There was lots of mergers and whatever, and the bank he was working for merged, and he'd been up on this, you know, ladder, climbing up and doing really well. And when that happened, he sort of thought, oh, there'll be multiple offers for me to consider, and that's not what happened. So then he went into another really dark period, and there was another DUI, and that one, unfortunately, involved my children. We had he was working from home at the time, because that bank job had ended, and he was doing some consulting, and I was working full-time, and I was... You know, I was always the one who would forget that it was a minimum day, or forget, you know, that it was a field trip day or whatever. I was just not that one. In fact, when they're little and it's their birthday, you could bring cupcakes to school, right? So one morning I'm driving my kid to school, and I'm realizing that it's his birthday, and I go, oh, I didn't make any cupcakes. And he said, it's okay, Mom. One of the other boys, his mom's a PTA mom, and she'll remember, because it's his birthday too. So, yeah. Yeah, I felt terrible. But so what happened was, this one morning I was at work and I realized that it was a minimum day and I hadn't made any plans for it. We had a nanny who would come and take care of the kids because he traveled, so there were times that he wasn't home. And she wasn't going to be there that day, so I called him and I said, hey, can you pick up the kids? And what I didn't know was that he had gotten up at, like, you know, 7:30 that morning, dropped off the kids, and then thought it was a good idea to go buy a small bottle of vodka and start drinking that. And so when it was time to go pick up the kids, he, I don't know if how it is down here, but we have these very crowded elementary schools, and there's like a traffic circle, and you wait for your kids, and all the moms, and you know, are lined up, and you have to be kind of orderly or whatever. Well, my daughter is 11 years old. She's in sixth grade, and my younger one, he was 8, and they walk out to the traffic circle, you know, looking for, you know, their dad, and he's standing out of the car, very disheveled, swearing at all the moms and yelling and screaming. So my daughter knew something was wrong, and she was very mortified. So she ushered her little brother and a couple of her girlfriends that were supposed to come over into the car, and he sped off and ran into a wall. And that's a very dramatic thing to say, and it was a wall, but thank God it was a little wall. It was the best made wall you could ever have. It was like that high, and I don't know what kind of rebar or whatever, river stones, because it was a very new sports car kind of sedan, and it totaled the car, but the wall was fine. And luckily, because it was a low wall, the inertia went out over the car and not back at my kids. So, but what that started was a terrible journey for particularly my daughter, but both of my kids. And my ex and I had been through so much by then. You know, there was, he had found out at one point that he tells me in an AA meeting that someone told him that it would help his sobriety if he did a little speed. So, and I'm, you know, my drug past is, I mean, literally very minor. I smoked a little pot, you know, I didn't know anything. And my kids tell me, call it weed, Mom. When you call it pot, you sound old. So I had smoked a little weed, you know, so I didn't really know what speed was. And I went to work and I said to my girlfriends, you know, he says he's doing speed. And they go, oh, that's meth. And I go, no. So then I go and I Google, and you know, I keep trying to find something that says something other than that. And anyway, there's a lot of funny stories, really sad but funny stories about that. But he did end up going to rehab for that, and he told me to tell his family that it was cocaine because it sounded cooler and more sophisticated than meth. Yeah. But that was before. So this was like, that had happened, and we had gone to rehab in November, and this was the spring, March. And I didn't know he was drinking. I really thought he was working a program and he was being sober and whatever. So it didn't occur to me to say, baby, did you drink this morning? Because I need you to drive the kids home, you know? So anyway, that was it for me, though. I feel like the way I always describe it is, if you guys are old enough to remember Get Well Smart, and when he's walking down the hall and all those doors go you know, yeah, do, and then all those doors slam shut, that's how I felt. I felt like my heart had been closing, but you know, you put my babies in a car and you run into a wall and I'm kind of done. And because my kids weren't hurt, thank God, it was sort of a gift in a weird kind of package. It was a gift because it was, if I had been in the car, for instance, you know, I probably would have explained it away or been okay, but it was my kids. So that was that. So that started our journey as, you know, going through a divorce, which took a super long time, and, you know, parenting separately. And but as I said, my daughter was 11 years old. And just going to be 12, right? That happened in March, and she graduated in June, and her birthday is June 23rd. She just turned 23. So what I didn't know is, in her little adolescent whatever, she was feeling a lot of angst. She felt super guilty about putting her friends and her brother into the car because she knew he was drunk. And so she felt super responsible for it and traumatized. And to this day, she's 23, she does not drive a car. She doesn't have a driver's license. So she's got a lot of phobias, a lot of fears about being alone, a lot of fears about, you know, whatever. But what I didn't know was that she started self-medicating and she started smoking weed. And she's, to use the vernacular, she smoked weed pretty much every day for probably till she was about 18, 19 years old. And what that did to her is, you know, I don't know, those of you who've, you know, when you do it, you sort of feel good. It sort of takes the edge off. And so you don't learn to deal with pain. You don't learn to deal with emotions. You don't learn to deal with difficulty or challenges. You just, everything sort of it's hard because she's doing really well now, and I'll tell you about that. But in the last 5 years, she's had to grow up from being 11 in a lot of ways. You know, people, when they start using, it's widely accepted that you sort of get stunted at that particular age, you know, emotionally, maturity-wise, whatever. I certainly see a lot of evidence of that, some of my alcoholic friends. But anyway, meanwhile, I'm kind of roadkill. I have my three kids. I stayed with my ex a lot of years that I can't even say shouldn't have, because, you know, everything happens for a reason. And what I do know is that I did the very, very best I could. But I had a lot of guilt and a lot of almost like self-loathing, because it's like I knew our marriage was bad. I knew it was bad for the children. I knew all of that, and yet I couldn't leave. And I could always picture my life and the kids after, you know, I could picture us living in you know, the four of us. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I did to sort of, it's like a little mind game, there was a house in the neighborhood and I really liked it, and I would drive by it, and I could just picture, I had been through it on like an open house, so I knew where all the bedrooms were and everything. And for a good bit of time, like maybe a year, I would drive by that and I would think, okay, I would put Eric in this bedroom, and I would do this, and this is what I would do in the backyard. And it was like a little fantasy and kind of an escape. So I could really picture being on the other side. What I couldn't picture was actually leaving. And part of it was, you know, because I still loved their dad, and I felt like even leaving a bad marriage, divorce is bad for kids, and, you know, I wasn't a quitter, and I believed in marriage, and I wanted my kids to have an intact family, yada, yada. But then there was also the ugly part of it, which was that I didn't want the stigma of being a single mom, because, you know, I was too cool for that. And I don't know why that even bothered me, but it did. And I was worried about financial, and I was worried that I couldn't do it. So there was all those, like, fear-based, you know, and not so lofty reasons why I stayed. But I had a lot of self-loathing about it, and I lived in ambivalence for a lot of years. So when that accident happened, I keep going back and forth, but when that accident happened, it was like the clouds parted and the sun shone down and the sky was blue, and it was so clear. So that was such a gift, because living in that ambivalence is no way to live. That's a little bit of hell, to be honest. So my daughters, I'm roadkill. I'm trying to, you know, figure out what I'm going to do with it, you know, as a single woman with my three kids and all of that. And unbeknownst to me, my daughter is not just smoking pot, but she's drinking, and she's kind of a garbage pail and doing whatever. And my older son was, she was 11, he was like 14, 15 years old, and he did a little bit of, like, probably more garden variety experimentation. And I remember thinking, God, there's a lot of skunks in this neighborhood. I'm always smelling skunk, and just so weird, you know. And, you know, you think that when you've done things as a teenager that, oh, my kids wouldn't be able to get this past me, but, you know, denial is very powerful. And I think that weed smells different now than it did when I was, you know, in the 70s. I've done a lot of weird things to the hybridization or whatever. Anyway, I don't remember it smelling like skunk, but now it does. Anyway, so I'm going out with some girlfriends one night, and I'm all ready to go out, and my daughter comes over to me, and she goes, "Mom," I'm like, "What?" She goes, "Oh, I need to talk to you," and I'm like, "What?" She goes, "Well, I had some ecstasy, and I've had it before," and I'm like, and then she says, "But I don't think this is good, and I think you need to take me to the hospital," and I'm like, "Oh my God," you know, we live really close to the hospital, we drive her to the hospital, the emergency room is packed with people, you know, crying babies and whatever, and I tell them it's ecstasy, and they whip us into a private room like that, you know, because I don't know much about it, but apparently it's kind of a garbage pail of a drug, and it's not, you know, you don't necessarily know what's in it, so they weren't going to take any chances, which I'm grateful for. But what happened then is my daughter had, you know, struggled with all this psychological stuff. I mean, the drug use was really self-medicating, but she had all these fears and all this anxiety and whatever, and she was really suffering in school, but she wasn't a discipline problem. You know, she didn't, you know, yell at the teachers or fight or whatever, so she just sort of was in the corner, and I could never get any help for her. So when we're in the hospital, they have a social worker come by, and they decided that it was a suicide attempt. And I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, that that's what it was. I just think she took something that was bad. But I was really pissed off. I was really pissed that the hospital was going to put that on her permanent record, whatever that is, and you know, that they were just covering their own ass and da 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 da. But what ended up happening is they put her into a lockdown, a 72-hour, you know, whatever, and I had to drive all, you know, across the country, it seemed like, you know, across the county anyway, to go visit her, and I mean, I was just so pissed off. But what it did was it opened up a whole bunch of support for us, because the school might ignore a depressed teen, but they don't ignore a suicidal teen. And so what happened from that is that we ended up getting the support we needed from her, for her, and then ultimately when it got so bad, I told my kids, if I can't keep you safe, I'm gonna find some place that you can be safe. And the school district, because starting with the fact that she was now a suicidal teen and she needed this and that, and by the time that she really had gone off the rails, they supported me in sending her to a treatment center in Colorado. And that was fabulous, because when I started looking into that, you know, treatment for teenagers, I realized that if you're Bill Gates and your kid has a drug problem, you're good. But the rest of us, how can you afford it? It's stupid expensive, you know? And so they sent her away. And when they did that, it was terrible. I had to have her ripped out of the bed in the middle of the night, because there was no way you were going to be able to say, "Okay, honey, now I want to send you away, or they're going to keep you kind of locked up, and you're not going to be able to see anybody." And now, you know, she wouldn't have packed her bags. So I had to do that for her, and that was really traumatic. But when she left, then I turn around and I look at my youngest, and he's a mess. He's, I guess he was 11 going on 12. That's a really big age in my family. But he's wearing a sweatshirt all the time. Turns out he's cutting himself. Turns out he's doing a lot of drugs too. And so I started my journey with him while my daughter's in away. Then I'm dealing with him, and lots of stories about, you know, they did inpatient, they did outpatient, they did long-term, they did this, they did that. I mean, I know what I'm talking about when I talk about paying for rehab and paying for rehab. And I believe that each one of those things are a part of the process. And my youngest, who is not really embracing sobriety right now, I know that he knows, you know, so I know that all that stuff isn't wasted. But he ultimately, he's the one that really kicks my butt and does still to this day. I went to an Al-Anon meeting, a Saturday morning meeting that I attend with Roger, and afterwards I thought, oh, I gotta get my nails done, and my phone had been off, because, you know, we do that during meetings, and I see that my older son's been calling me a bunch of times, and so instead of going to get my nails done, I go home, and my son was had overdosed. And he was purple and not breathing and whatever. And It was terrible, and I'm traumatized to this day, but, you know, he didn't die. Thank God. He was okay, and he spent 6 days in a pediatric ICU unit, and it was so weird. There he is, my drug-using, overdosed kid, and there's little fishes on the wall and, like, little, you know, rivers and stuff in the linoleum and all these little kids with teddy bears, and they're like, well, what are you there for, you know? Because I guess he was 15. But because of starting with my daughter's quasi-suicide attempt, the school district had me on their radar, and they were able to send him to a really great treatment center where he wasn't just a drug treatment center, it was a psychiatric treatment center. So he got a lot of really, good quality, not boot camp, but really like, you know, what is that called? The rapid eye movement, you know, post-traumatic stress type of therapy, really good. So he came home and I was thinking, okay, so we're gonna team speak at 12-step meetings, you know, the supportive mom and the, you know, AA champion teen and whatever. Well, that's not what happened. At first I had like an app on his phone so I could see where he was all the time, and I was drug testing him and this and that. And at this point he's like 17 and it's his senior year in high school. And it became really obvious very soon that he didn't want sobriety. And at that point, you know, he'd been in short-term inpatient rehab two or three times. He'd been in outpatient many times. He'd been in therapy, and then he'd been in this long-term, year-long treatment. And I thought to myself, okay, so I drug test him and it comes out positive. Now what? You know, what do you do at that point? So I set an alarm for when he was 18, because, you know, when they turn 18, then you don't have to necessarily pay for the messes they make, so it's a really big age, it's good. But I had to learn to let go. I had to learn to get let go, and that's where I am right now. My daughter, she did all that experimentation with drugs when she came back from her rehab. She had about a year of sobriety, and then she went off the rails again. But when she went off the rails again, it was just pretty much just alcohol. And that got so bad that about 8 months ago, she contacted me and said, you know, Mom, I want to go back to, you know, this local rehab, which she'd been to many times. Every time I had arranged it, I had contacted my insurance company, got the pre-approval, found out if there was a bed, da-da-da-da-da-da, packed her bags. This time, she wasn't living with me, and she did it on her own, you know, called the insurance, like a grown-up, called the insurance company, got it all squared away, and it took her a couple of, she went actually through it twice, 6 years, but she just called me just before we came in here, and she's got 6 months of sobriety now, so that's really good. What I've learned in parenting, alcoholic addicts, it's different than being married to one, because you know when you're married, you may have a sick, you know, for lack of a better term, codependent, you know, enmeshed kind of a relationship, but you know that you can replace him. With a child, it ain't that way. You know, they're your own kid, and the other hard part of it is, you know, they come out and they're little teeny babies and they need everything from you, and so you, right out the gate, you're taking care of all their needs and fixing everything and teaching them how to walk and how to talk, and then they fall down and they scrape their knee and you kiss their boo-boos and you put band-aids on it and you teach them how to do their arithmetic and all that, and then they get to be a hormonal teen with a drug problem and there's not a damn thing you can do. And that is really hard. It's really hard. And my feeling about it, having gone through it twice, is that you pretty much have to do everything that you can do up until the time that they turn 18, because you just have to be able to live with yourself, you know? But that's me. Everybody's path is different. And then you have to get to the point where you have some surrender. And my daughter, for instance, in my surrendering and letting go and stop giving her advice and stop asking her how much she's drinking and asking her if she's gone to meetings and doing all that stuff that was so helpful, she's found it on her own. You know, she found it on her own. And in the same way that I thought that her being hospitalized for the suicide attempt was, I crazy and I was angry, whatever. Well, where she is now, she's at a sober living, and she'd gone through, you know, a 30-day program, gone out, another 30-day program, so that was like a 70-day program or time period. And then she got out, she went into a sober living, and like 20 days later, so you can do the math, you know, very newly sober, they asked her if she would manage the house. And I'm going, what? Clearly this place is run by alcoholics, right? And I'm thinking, she was in their rehab, so they have fingers and toes, they can do the math, you know. She was so newly sober, but you know what? It has been such a blessing. It's been such a blessing. It is, she's got such pride, she's, you know, her motivation, probably because she belongs in these rooms too, to help the other girls in the house makes her want to do better herself, and, you know, it's been really great. Now she thinks she wants to have a career in that direction, whatever, and it's a example, as I learned so much in my life, is that I really don't know, you know. I do read the big book a little bit, and you know, we all love that chapter about acceptance, and one of the things that it says in there is that if I don't know what's best for me, I certainly don't know what's best for you, I don't know what's best for anybody, you know. And that's what I think probably parenting teaches, that to a certain extent, if you're open to it anyway, even in the absence of drugs and alcohol. But certainly in parenting someone with a substance abuse problem, you really find out that you don't know. I can't, you know, that as a parent, you have so many fears, and I have a tendency, even when they were really little, we had a swimming pool that had like a rock edge, and I could always picture them cracking their heads open and blood, you know, filling the pool. And, you know, so I could always think of the worst case scenario. And, you know, all that borrowed worry for something that never happens, you know. And so I try to be mindful of that now, so that when my daughter met a heroin addict in the first run of this most recent rehab, and I was just picturing, you know, them sharing needles and whatever, and that didn't happen, so I lost a lot of sleep and whatever, and she kind of came to her senses and didn't continue that relationship. But I just learned that they have their own higher power, and their own higher power knows better than I do. And you know, I might have an idea of, for them to be happy and healthy and successful, they need to do, and then they do something that's completely different, and that's what brings them success and happiness. And so it's a difficult balance. My youngest, my oldest is kind of like butter. He's, you know, does his thing. He's like a big grown man. It's really exciting. He has a job and a girlfriend, and everything's going good. So, and then my second one, she just had this, you know, she's got 6 months of sobriety and is, you know, working really hard or doing really well. And then my youngest, he went away to college, which was a miracle, frankly, because his transcripts were a little weird, going to Utah for a year and all of the other school that he missed and whatever, but he got accepted, so did really good the first semester. The second semester, this past semester, I didn't hear from him much, and I started, my mom, little nee, 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 spidey sense started going off, and turns out that he didn't pass those classes. I'm still not 100% sure what happened, so is it depression, is it anxiety, is it partying, is it drug use, is it, I don't know, and I'm at this crossroads right now where I don't quite know what to do with him. He's 19, he's not going back up to the Bay Area, which is where he went to school, because when I sent him away, I said, look, I you know, as long as you do what you're supposed to do, then I'll support you in this way, but if you party too much or whatever, because you know how it is, you know, living in the dorms and everything, then I said, I'm not going to do that for you. So I have to follow through with that, you know, and do say what you mean and don't say it mean and all that stuff. So now I have this 19-year-old who's lived away from me for a year, moving back home, and my daughter, the boundaries were easier with her. You know, it was very clear to me when I could no longer have her in my home from some of her behavior. It was very clear to me where she's at, because she wears her crazy out on her sleeve when she's in a bad place, you know. my son is very subversive. He's very quiet. You know, the things he does typically are to himself, and you know, I never know where he's at. So now I have to figure out what do I do with this man child, you know, who's an adult, and how do I live in my house with him with appropriate boundaries? I want it to feel like home, but I don't want him to make me miserable either, you know? And so it's a whole new chapter. And what I know is that, and it's also scary, frankly, because of that overdose. Anytime he sleeps in, I'm afraid, you know? I want to, you know, put my ear on the door and make sure I'm hearing breathing. I mean, it's bad, you know? And I have to shake myself, okay. And there's more of that borrowed worry, you know? So where I'm at right now is just not knowing what this next chapter is gonna look like, and what's the right thing to do. But what I do know is that I go to a parent focus meeting every week, and I see what other parents have done, and sometimes I see what other parents have done and I go, oh, I don't think I wanna do that. And you know, and then sometimes I see people and I go, wow, I could try that. But it's everybody's path is their own. They're, you know, in that group of, I don't know, 60 families that are probably regular attenders and shifts, you know, some of them have pay the rent of their kids, some of them are raising their grandkids, some of them are having their kids live with them, some of them are not, some of them, you know, don't talk to their kids, some of them, you know, are their best friends or whatever. There's all these different things, all different ways of coping with a family problem of alcoholism. And the people, for instance, who are not talking to their kids, you know, that's not what I want, but you know what? I trust that will work itself out, you know. Someone told me one time that, you know, I might have been here, I don't know. If I was, it's not original, but you know, if you have like an algebra equation and you say A plus B equals C, C is the relationship, A and B is you and me or me and my kid or whatever. If A changes me, then C is gonna change whether B does or not. So those people whose kids choose not to talk to them, as they grow in their recovery and they learn how to, you know, to give them the dignity of being pissed off little brats or whatever they are, whatever's motivating them not to talk to them, parents, terrible. But whatever that is, if they change and take care of themselves and live their life, then that relationship's gonna change. And so the miracles that you get to see is you get to see people who weren't as lucky as me, whose kids didn't make it through, you know, that type of a thing. And yet they still have lives where they can smile and they can laugh and they can live, you know, with a loss, you know, a big chunk of their heart gone for sure. You know, there's, you know, how could you do that? I don't know. But I have hope. I have hope that even though I'm not all the way through it, you know, and even with my daughter, as hopeful as I am and as much as I'm celebrating her success and everything, I don't know how long it's going to last. You know, but I can live in today and be grateful for what I have today, but I can also have hope in knowing that, you know, if I can look back at the little sordid path that I've had, and God's brought me through all of it, and, you know, my life is not what I would have planned, you know. I would have pictured myself being with their dad, you know, retiring together and playing with the grandkids together and whatever, and, but, you know, having this second chapter has opened up a life to me that I never would have known. You know, I've got a lot of things in my life that I didn't even know I liked to do when I was married, because I was focused on being married and being a mom and whatever. And so, you know, you just don't know. You just don't know. Just like I don't know what's good for you and what's good for my kids, I don't even know what's good for me. So I'm just grateful. I'm grateful that I have a relationship with my higher power, and I have all of you to give me strength and to show me, you know, that there's hope. Anyway, that's all I got. Thanks.
Let's thank Cynthia one more time. Bill W., will you please read the Al-Anon closing?